2011-60116, Akers versus Hines Community College.
Your Honor, for the record, I am Luther Munford with the Phelps Dunbar Firm in Jackson, Mississippi. And with me at council table is Todd Butler, also of our firm. We're here representing Hines Community College. We're here because during a four-month period in early 2006, Hines Community College did two things. First, in order to meet an accreditation requirement, the college assigned the plaintiff teacher to courses other than the economics course that she preferred to teach. There was no change in her salary or benefits.
You might want to move your mic up just a little. It's a little
you need to have your mic up a little higher if you can. Will it go any higher? I'm sorry to make you the microphone purveyor for taking.
I was in a rock and roll band in high school, but I'm afraid they gave me a mic and turned it down.
Well,
so I guess
and we'll spot you the 25 seconds or so of this so that you won't lose your time.
I'm sorry, I didn't realize that was such an
ordeal.
Yeah,
but
there you go.
I think we'll be able to hear you better, and that's good for all of us.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate that very much. As I said, we're here representing Hines Community College, and we're here because during a four-month period, early 2006, the college did two things. First, it reassigned a teacher to teach courses other than the economics course that she preferred to teach. It did so because of accreditation requirements, and it caused no change in salary or benefits. The second thing is that after she protested the course assignment change by saying that her department head was unprofessional and unethical, that department head chose another person, the dean chose another person to be chair of the department. It's a four-person department. Chose another person to be chair of the department. And the person chosen was someone who was working toward a graduate degree in community college administration. And obviously, this was the first step for that teacher to become a community college administrator. The jury found there was no gender discrimination. No gender discrimination. But the jury found in favor of the plaintiff on retaliation. And the question is whether the record contains facts sufficient to support a finding, either that the reassignment was a materially adverse employment action, or that the reasons given were a pretext and were in fact retaliation for the fact that 4 years before, the professor had been listed as a witness in a discrimination case brought by a faculty member in another department.
Counsel, one of their, actually, her first example of adverse employment action was the requirement that she get the full 16 graduate hours. Is there any issue developed in this record about the college having any alternative except to comply with that for their teachers of economics?
No. It was an 18-hour requirement. It had been a historic requirement, but they went to it, but the accreditation authorities demanded it. She admitted, at the time she denied it, and she said, it's not true, I don't believe it, et cetera. But eventually, on the stand, she admits it at page 983. The requirement is Exhibit J-17. A memo about it is J-27. And Exhibit D-7 is, after everything else has happened, the Accreditation Standards Committee issues a report and said that she basically should not have been teaching economics in 2005 and 2006 when she was teaching it. That is completely unimpeached.
Counsel, you know the law has relaxed about what the adverse employment action is. It used to be much more stringent, but now all sorts of things are being considered adverse employment actions and consequences that are more minimal than they used to be, and the Supreme Court's relaxed that precedent. And as an economics major, I think some could say that teaching economics is better than teaching the intro to business. So if we spot them like that, tell me what the evidence was in the record that there was a causal connection between the incident 4 years earlier. That's what, you know, obviously there's no sufficient temporal connection that you could assume that. What was the evidence in the record of, I mean, I'm going to ask the other side that question too. It's really their problem to tell me, but can you tell me what the evidence was in the record?
Yes, I will. And I want to say, I think it's extremely important that this court not find that a college changing a teacher from one course to another is adverse employment action. But the causation issue that you raise is the dispositive issue of the whole case. There are basically three things that the court has considered. One is the strength and legitimacy of the non-retaliatory reason. The second is the proximity in time. And the third is decision-maker knowledge. And I'd like to address those in turn. First, the strength and legitimacy of the non-retaliatory reason. I've just laid out the non-retaliatory reason for asking another teacher to teach economics who was qualified under those standards and not the plan. With respect to the department chair choice, I believe this court's cases on clearly better qualified come into play, and she has not shown that she was clearly better qualified than the teacher who was studying to be a college administrator, professional college administrator. In some cases, that's decisive, and in this case, I think the academic credential requirement is decisive. The college couldn't have done anything else.
Yeah, but on the chair position, they could have made her chair. There was no accreditation rule that said she couldn't
that's
be chair.
Right.
I understand
that's
that when
right.
you know, are mean to the dean, he may not want to make you chair. I get that, but there was no prohibition on it.
That's exactly right.
And that is clearly an adverse employment event, failing to promote. We don't need to get too deep into one course or the other to find that, do we?
That's exactly right.
Okay.
That's exactly right. And as I said, there's three things that are considered, and I'm only saying that the strength of the non-discriminatory reason is adequate as to the course assignment. I agree that they didn't have to make her chair, but she also didn't show that she was clearly better qualified, which is relevant to the court's decision.
Can you continue to do prongs two and three? Go ahead.
Well, with respect to proximity and time, there's a case we've cited in briefs, Campbell v. England. It's not a reported decision, but it is a decision of this court. And what the court said about time is very interesting. It said, this circuit has only allowed lapses of up to 4 months to go to the jury as evidence of pretext. And the Supreme Court has cited with approval cases holding that 3 and 4 month spans were too long to show pretext. That's at start page 4 of that opinion.
The time cuts in your favor because it's such a lengthy amount of time.
Definitely. And then the other factor, Your Honor, is the decision maker's knowledge. And there's just a complete failure of proof that these decision makers had any knowledge or certainly any recollection that 4 years before she had been listed on a witness list in a pretrial order.
But is that a credibility matter? Because they forgot? Is that something that's for the fact finder on that? That's the hard one for me.
There's no proof that they ever knew, but it's also true there's no proof that they remember.
Okay, so that I want to focus on the. I agree that if they're just saying they knew it once and they forgot, that's completely credibility. I'm questioning whether there's any evidence they knew.
There's no evidence.
Is there any evidence that they were sort of around the knowledge? In other words, that. The dean was the person who was the interface on that particular case and therefore would be the client contact to receive interrogatory answers and so forth.
There's no evidence that the dean ever received any interrogatory answers. It was the dean's appointment that was at issue. The dean had made someone else a department chair, and that was an issue in the case. But she was not in that department. She did not have any personal knowledge of anything that went
on. No, and I'm being very specific, and I'm not saying what you're saying is irrelevant, but I remember as a lawyer, I would have a corporate-type client, a college or a company or whatever, and you had to have a client contact because it's a company or it's an entity. Was he the client contact?
No, the college had an African-American administrator in another campus who was there. He handled the EEOC type.
And so that was the person.
That was the college contact according to the.
I mean, you understand what I mean by.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
There is no evidence, it's complete failure of proof. There's no evidence that Dean Kelly ever got a letter with her name on it, a pleading with her name on it, no email to him about her. There's no proof that he was ever asked about her in a deposition. There's no proof that she ever talked to the dean about the subject, either the case or the subject. There's no proof that Ms. Duncan, who was the person who was claiming discrimination, ever mentioned her name to the dean. This whole incident was never mentioned during this four-month time period in 2006 when all these other things were going on.
Did she bring it up? Did she say, I think that I'm not being considered favorably because of this thing in the past? Or was there any testimony of that?
The treatment changed after the she showed as a witness.
There is a claim about that.
That's her claim.
First of all, one interesting thing is there no claim that there was retaliation against anyone else. There's no claim that there was any retaliation against the woman who actually brought the EEOC charge. There's no claim that any other witness that she named was discriminated. There's just nothing in the record about that.
Is there evidence in the record that she was retaliated against in the period in between that from the day, I mean, is there a big long period where she's not retaliated against in her theory, and then all of a sudden she's starting to be retaliated against, or is there cumulative retaliation in her case?
Opposing counsel went to a treatise and pulled out a section of a treatise that talks about pattern of discrimination, and they're trying to make this fit those facts, but they don't fit. And the reason why is all of these things she complains about, the facts are not disputed. It's not like the Bazan case, for example, where the officer says she bit me, but there's no proof, he bit me and there's no proof that the hand is ever bitten. The facts are undisputed. It's all her characterization. In 2002, she says she was written up for missing class. She missed the class, and there was no adverse consequence to her. In 2003, she says an international program was canceled. It was. It's undisputed that the federal grant was canceled and that only four students signed up for the class. But she wants to make that about her. It wasn't. It had nothing to do with her. Family medical leave. They allowed her to take family medical leave on Tuesdays and Thursdays in the spring of 2004. She wanted to take double leave and go to a honor society thing in Chicago, and the dean thought she shouldn't be doing both at the same time, but they let her do both at the same time. She taught full-time in the summer. In the fall, she came in and 2 weeks into the semester says, I want family medical leave act this semester too. And they had to readjust, but they did it. 2005, there's no claim of any kind of retaliation. Throughout this whole period, she is rated the number one professor in this department. She is, at the same time the department chair decision is being made, they name her one of the best teachers of the year.
Why did they remove her from her subject matter if she's one of the best teachers of the year?
Because of the 18-hour requirement. There was a vacancy in the department in the fall of 2005. They had to hire somebody. And they hired a Professor Ashby, who in fact had the 18 hours. And so they gave it to him.
I mean, were they going to lose their accreditation if they kept her teaching economics?
It is, all I can say is that the accreditation people wrote them up and said you shouldn't do it. And some of those requirements are stupid. The accreditation people said that you couldn't teach horseback riding unless you had a degree in equestrian management. Okay?
Okay, so you're
but
saying
the college has to do its best. They have to sign a statement saying we will comply with these requirements.
Okay.
You know.
And having said that, they got to do it.
Sorry?
Having said we won't have someone who doesn't have 18 hours teach economics that can't have acres teach economics.
That's right. And as I said, Exhibit D7 shows at the end the college was in fact criticized for the fact
that. So, how did you guys lose this case? I'm serious. I have that question because it seems like there's not a lot on her side.
I think there are two issues, Your Honor, and one of them's really serious. The first issue is I don't think the college didn't like these requirements, and so it's very hard to defend them to a jury. And it's arbitrary, you know. The second thing is that by claiming retaliation, she turned a case that had nothing to do with race into a race case. Because the lady that she was supposed to be a witness for was African American. And she got up and testified, and, you know, she was glad she helped her. But there's nothing in the rest of this case that has anything to do with race. There's no, you know, but it has emotional impact on the jury. I see my time's expired.
Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Nick Norris. I represent Ms. Akers. I guess first to answer Judge Elrod's question regarding causation. One of the first things that Ms. Akers has alleged is she engaged in protected activity by writing a written statement to the EOC in the spring of 2003. Ms. Akers believes that the defendant first retaliated, I'm sorry, the spring of 2002. First retaliated against her in that same season in the spring of 2002 with an unfounded write-up where she missed an excused day of absence. The defendant says, well, she did miss the day, but that's not the write-up, and it was
she got written up for missing the class without getting permission ahead of time.
She hadn't been required to seek that in the 24 years she was there. That was never a requirement. This came out of the blue. She'd had some.
Was that a requirement?
No.
In the handbook or whatever, that you get permission?
She had not been, I don't know if it was specifically in the handbook, but she had not been required to do it in her 24 years of practice. She had someone to fill in for her. Her absence was excused, and that was an issue for the jury.
Who excused it?
It wasn't a specific where a supervisor came in and excused it. It was merely that she had a particular reason to excuse it. She did not have to go to the dean to get an excuse prior to missing that
day. And she
day.
Didn't have to let him know that she was
no.
doing that?
No, she never had in the past on there.
Okay, so that there's that incident. And then they canceled the international program in 2003. Is that
yes,
your next
the fall
incident?
2003, this is a program that Ms. Akers specifically installed herself. She was the head of the international program.
But there's no government money to pay for it.
There was government money to pay for it if they had sought the grant. They didn't pursue the grant any further, and that's why there wasn't any government money. There's the same thing with this hour requirement. They go to Ms. Akers didn't have the specific hour requirement. Well, she didn't know she had the specific hour requirement. They didn't tell her until April of 2006. They don't tell you that for a reason. But they knew she didn't have the hours. They went out and hired a gentleman. They didn't just hire him to fill in that department. They hired him. The contract for Mr. Ashley is in the record. Look at the contract. It's for economics. There were no other economics classes for him to teach than Ms. Akers' economics classes.
But you don't doubt that they got written up because she's not doesn't have the hours. That's all
no,
true.
No, it's all true that she does not have the hours, and had she been given notice of it, she would have been able to get the hours like the other professors in the university or in the college that were notified of it, did get the hours, and got to continue teaching in the fall. That's
what's the evidence of her ability to go out and get all these hours in the time allotted?
She has testified that she could have gone out and got those at different universities at Jackson State and at different local universities and during the summer to finish those hours up. That is her testimony.
What was she lacking, like 12 hours?
I believe so.
Is this like 12 hours of semester hours?
Yes, 12 semester hours.
So it would be like virtually a full-time load for a semester is what you're saying.
Split between two semesters.
Has she since gotten the hours?
No, she's retired. Ms. Akers retired in 2005, I believe. 2009 or 10, I apologize.
Do you have any other alleged retaliatory incidents other
sure.
than these?
Sure. In December 2003, Dr. Kelly started making it harder on taking FMLA. They say, well, she finally got the FMLA, though that was after Dr. Kelly denied it. She had to appeal that up and say, no, this is required by law. If it was up to Dr. Kelly, she wouldn't be getting this leave. She had to continually fight this all the way through, and Dr. Kelly wasn't going to make it easy for her. Again, in the spring of 2004, interfered with medical leave to take care of her family. Then in January 2005, when they first learned of the 18-hour requirement, this is January 2005, it wasn't to the fall of 2006 it would have taken place, and they didn't tell her for over a year and a half about the requirement. So, you know, you're running into about 2 years that she would have had to get this requirement had they told her when she first learned about it.
Then in October 2000, is there anything linking these alleged acts of retaliation to the testifying?
I'm sorry, sir.
Is there anything evidence that links this to the testifying? You know, there's an incident a year. They're explainable for other reasons. Is there anything that links them up to the testifying, that she's gone in and said, you're treating me differently ever since I testified, or that there's some emails that we don't like her anymore?
Email or written statement where she's specifically saying you are doing this because of this.
And there's no email between the alleged perpetrator, Dr. Kelly, and his assistant or other leaders that say, we don't like her, she's not a team player anymore, and nothing like that in this
record. There's not a specific shooting gun with that. What we have here is Dr. Kelly continually changing his story about when he became knowledgeable of the protected activity. And what you have here is where the court puts up a 3-month or 4-month barrier for causation. A lot of times it doesn't take into thought of the retaliatory mind, where the deviant retaliatory mind that knows of these requirements and knows how to hide things.
But that's not for us to say, is it? That's if our court's already said that temporal connection needs to be much closer, then it's not for us to say something different.
I believe that in general there is that temporal proximity, and we have provided that. But what I'm talking about is knowledge of the protected activity. And here, where Dr. Kelly knew that if he admitted he became aware of it, and it wasn't just some EEOC officer, it was their in-house counsel, who was also trial counsel, not Mr. Mumford here, that presided at this. And the action in the first case where Ms. Duncan had to claim discrimination by Dr. Kelly, Ms. Akers was her primary witness, saying, yes, this is discrimination, that he's not following the policy on there, and that's what he was retaliating against.
And that was,
and he continually
at the same
lied.
Time that was happening.
Yes,
it was against him personally.
Yes,
and she was the main witness.
She was the main
so
witness.
So you think there's an inference there that he knew good and well, since it's about him personally.
Not
that
just
she
that,
was
but
the main
fact
witness.
That he kept on changing his story about when he became aware of the protected activity. It's the first time I think he said was shortly before I took his deposition. And then at summary judgment, he filed an affidavit that said, well, he found out at the lawsuit, because that didn't make a whole lot of sense. And then after he realized that we'd caught him in so many contradictions, he shows up at trial and says, oh, well, I just don't remember. Because he doesn't want to be pinpointed down to when he became aware of it, because he knows when he became aware of it. And he knew that if he said anywhere in Ms. Akers' lawsuit, it really wasn't going to make sense. That he wasn't aware of the primary witness that was making allegations against him as well.
Okay, but the EEOC filing, was that against him personally, or was he just the star witness for the other side in a case against the college?
That was against him personally.
Okay.
Against him as a decision. What happened in Janice Duncan's case, he did a very similar thing where it was a department chair position, and he came in, I believe it was a meeting with Janice Duncan, and said, okay, I'm not going to have this panel that's required by the Hines Community College. I'm just going to have the teachers among you vote as to who should be the chair, and violate the principal to make sure, and also didn't inform certain teachers that he knew that would vote for Ms. Duncan, didn't inform them of the meeting so they wouldn't show up and vote for Ms. Duncan. It was very obvious he wasn't following procedures. Now, the defendant also makes a mention, well, he did the same procedure for other things. Yes, that's true. But what that shows is that Dr. Kelly is going to do what Dr. Kelly wants to do. He doesn't care about the law, and he doesn't care about the policy set out by Hines Community College, and whether it's the purpose is to retaliate against Ms. Akers or it's to just pick whoever he wants, he's going to do what Dr. Kelly wants to do.
My colleagues may have further questions about the merits, but I have a question about the damages.
Yes, ma'am.
Why don't we have to remit even if you win?
Well, first, they've raised the maximum recovery rule. I believe that argument first is waived because it was not brought down at the lower court. There's been some other law review articles written regarding these issues, and one of the issues to correct.
So that was never raised before the trial court?
It was never raised before the trial court. They brought up remittiture, but never referenced the maximum recovery rule, never referenced many of the cases to support this finding. Not until they hired Mr. Mumford to do the appeal did they raise the maximum recovery rule.
So they should have hired him sooner.
They should have hired him to do the trial, obviously, and bring this on remittiture. But as well, I don't believe the maximum recovery rule should apply. I believe Justice Dennis in the Thomas v. Texas Department of Criminal Justice has issued numerous reasons why the maximum recovery rule should not be applied. For instance, where the defendant is cited in many of these cases are only summaries. What you have here before you is a complete record where you can look at all the testimony, as well as there's only a small sample of cases where you limit it to the Fifth Circuit. There's not many cases, mainly because...
Counsel, pardon me for interrupting you, but I'd rather you talk about the Supreme Court and what the Constitution has been said to say about reviewing a verdict, and not anything that the Fifth Circuit has dreamed up, which has absolutely no connection with the law.
I was getting to that.
What do you say about a reasonable juror not being able to go to $350,000?
Well, Your Honor, I would agree with your decision in the Vogler case where you had referenced that the maximum recovery rule is inappropriate to the Seventh Amendment and that these should
That's
only
not
be reviewed.
The law. I think you just skip that. Delete what I just said. Just forget about maximum recovery. But okay. What about reviewing a verdict?
Well, as with Vogler, you mentioned with reviewing the verdict, it should, with regard to these emotional pain and suffering, the Supreme Court has said it should review on the shock of the conscience of the court. And I believe that is the issue that really is before the court, is whether Ms. Akers here, who had practiced in economics or taught economics for 24 years, over half of her life, had that taken away from her and then had the humiliation of having this gentleman that was a football coach.
Well, what's the evidence? What's the evidence about humiliation and how suffered she was?
Sure. I would point to the record. It was quite extensive on this, but particularly Ms. Akers testified that she had been humiliated. This had been her identity. In the Hines Community College is in Raymond, Mississippi. It's a very small town. Hines Community College involves, I would say, 75% of the town. And she is known as the economics professor for 24 years. This was her life. That was taken away from her. She testified that she would normally go home every day and cry, and that she would be so embarrassed for not getting that chair position, having her economics stage, she wouldn't even eat with the professors that she had worked with her entire life. That's truly embarrassing, to not even feel comfortable to sit down and have a meal with the individuals you've worked with for over two decades. The defendant wants to, or the appellant wants to specify about, oh, well, there's not a hospitalization, but that's not required. And they want to refer the court to Vady and to other smaller verdicts, but they're not similar. And this court has time and time again said that these cases are very hard to similarize, and as Judge Dennis has said, and a lot of times when you're looking at this, similarity is all in the eye of the beholder, and you're running into a results-orientated manipulation of these opinions on there to say that Vady is more similar than Giles or any other case that's been cited here, and there's nothing like this, and where this court has really a cold record. It wasn't able to sit down and see Ms. Akers testify and see Ms. Duncan testify like a jury And Judge Lee was a senior district judge that has been on the panel for a long time. He, you know, to have both those affirm that this is reasonable, this does not shock the conscience of the courts, says quite a lot.
What was the basis for the remittiture that was sought before the trial court?
I'm sorry, can you say
what was the basis, the reasoning given for the seeking of the remittiture? You said they sought it, but they didn't say maximum
they
recovery.
They just said it shocked the conscience of the court.
Just shocked the conscience.
Yes, if you, and I believe that is in the record, that they just said they shocked, they do not reference maximum recovery rule.
But isn't maximum recovery rule just a way of gauging the shocked conscience? Because it's not a subjective thing like my personal conscience, which may or may not be shocked by the same amount that shocks my two colleagues and so on. Isn't that an objective way to look at the shock?
The maximum recovery rule is that way, but the problem is you start, as I mentioned earlier, is you start doing a comparative analysis of cases that you can't really compare. When you look, for instance, whether the...
No, I'm just getting to whether they preserved the issue. Not whether you win or lose on the issue, but whether they preserved it. It seems to me if you've made the argument that it shocks the conscience and maximum recovery is a way of analyzing that, I don't know that you have to cite every case. You should. As a former district judge, you don't go sandbagging a district judge. But I don't know that the fact that you don't cite a case to the district court means you can't cite it to the circuit court, because law isn't dependent on whether lawyers cite it or not.
I agree with that, that it's not a requirement to cite a specific case. But it is a requirement to specify a specific legal theory, and that's what the maximum recovery rule is. It's not just that they didn't cite a particular case, they didn't cite the maximum recovery rule at all or infer to it. That's the requirement, is they do have to cite it. And that's one of the recommendations, I believe a Texas Tech Law Review had mentioned as a potential remedy to cure up the maximum recovery rule, where a lot of times Judge Lee here didn't get the opportunity to take this argument up. He did take up the shock the conscience of the court and denied it, but he did not take up the maximum recovery rule and was not allowed the opportunity to even view these issues because they did not cite that to the court. But as Judge Reilly mentioned, I don't believe the maximum recovery rule should apply. I believe it's contrary to the U.S. Supreme Court precedent on the issue, and that the court should go back to shock the conscience of the court, which is the appropriate remedy. Where we have the maximum recovery rule, it seems quite unfair in general with the percentages. If I try a case today and get a $100,000 verdict, and we have the same facts, same emotional pain and suffering, and a colleague of mine tries it 3 months later, he can get 150% more than I did, merely because he tried it a few months later. How does that make any sense? That's not fair. But that's what this court's done. And with the small amount of cases you have, and if you go back to Mr. Mumford's, say, well, everything should go down to the 10,000, we'll just slowly move up in 150% increments, but we'll never get to 300,000 the way Fifth Circuit affirms jury verdicts on employment cases. It's very frankly, it's what the record. If you start looking, it's pretty hard to find them.
Appreciate your candor.
I was going to say, that was so respectfully said, and yet so...
Everyone else...
I don't know. So something...
Everyone, yes. You know, everyone Gutsy. Else says it. Might as well say the obvious on there. There's no reason to say it behind your back. And everyone writes law reviews about
Fair
it.
Fair enough. I appreciate that. Do you want to go back to your merits, just to give it the best shot you got on the merits?
Sure. Within regard to the merits, there is one issue that they brought in their reply brief that they said that I had brought an appellate fallacy. Saying that Ms. Akers really knew about the 18-hour requirement in January, but she had testified that she didn't become aware of it in April of 2006. I do want to address that specifically because it wasn't particularly briefed. In particular, Ms. Akers, I believe, in the record, specified that she had made a mistake in that testimony, and the jury has the ability to decide, yes, that was a mistake, and disregard that testimony. She also testified that she wasn't even at that convocation to be informed, as Dr. Hogan said. So that argument by Mr. Mumford is just clearly incorrect. A lot of his briefing is specified as if he were writing a brief on summary judgment, but here we have a jury and a judge that has heard the complete case and has ruled in our favor and found causation.
So we have to defer to the inference in your favor.
Yes, Your
on
Honor.
That point.
Yes, Your
that
Honor.
That she did not, and there's some evidence in the record that she did not know until much later of the requirement. And correct. We have to defer to that, assume that for purposes of our analysis.
That's correct. Mr. Mumford makes a lot of factual arguments as if we're retrying the entire case, but under the clearly erroneous standard, that's not the requirement here. It's to you have to assume all the facts go in my favor on that, and that Mr. Mumford's factual arguments about the EEOC finding no show cause or anything like that is irrelevant, and that the jury properly discarded that. And with he mentions the EEOC finding no cause, but the EEOC didn't have all the facts in the record at trial. There, with particular Dr. Kelly changing his testimony numerous times as to when he discovered the protected activity. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Norris.
Opposing counsel has a number of things just wrong and backwards. There is no testimony that she was a primary witness. Let me tell you where in the record the testimony is. The only testimony about what she did was she testified she was not subpoenaed, she was on a witness list, and the case settled, page 853 of the record. Ms. Duncan testified that Duncan filed a charge and a lawsuit and listed Akers as a witness during each. That's page 1069 of the record. That's
it is a charge against Mr. Kelly, Professor Dr.
It was
Kelly
against
personally.
Professor Kelly, but it was borderline insanity what she was going to testify about.
Borderline what?
Insanity. There is a procedure.
Well, then he might be really mad if she was going to testify about borderline insanity and retaliate against her.
Well, no. I mean, it was. She and Professor Duncan had a theory that you had to use a committee to choose a department chair because that's the way it was done before Dr. Kelly came. Dr. Kelly adopted a procedure, which is J21 in the record. His superior, Vice President Hogan, said it was correct. And it says that Dr. Dean Kelly.
But does it matter what the strength of Duncan's case was on racial discrimination to the question of whether Dean Kelly is mad at Akers for supporting her?
There is no evidence to that. In fact, the only evidence is he didn't get mad at her until 2007 when she did something.
We had this whole write-up when she shouldn't have been written up and the. Government grant, and they should have told her about the 18-hour requirement sooner. And so there's this kind of, the question is there enough of, do we have more than a couple of scintillas here so that the jury verdict gets affirmed? I mean, the fact is they've got a jury verdict. That's a pretty big deal.
Let me give you two cases. One is the Cheney case, Cheney v. New Orleans Public Facilities. This court fired for refusing to do the job, 2-year gap. He had filed an affidavit in a race case against his boss, and he told the boss that he was testifying against him. And this court said that was insufficient to show.
Is that a summary judgment case?
I'm sorry, I don't recall your name. There's also the Matto, M-A-T-O case involving a Texas A&M professor. There was a change curriculum requirement to require a PhD, and this court said you can't rely on disbelief alone.
Was that a summary judgment case?
I don't know, Your Honor.
You understand?
But
it's
I will
very
tell you, all of these cases are decided as a matter of law.
Right, but the issue, I have a question about whether or not we have to assume that he did know, if there's an inference that can be made that he knew of the testimony because it was against him and it was on a list in a case that's personally involving him, don't we have to infer in favor of the jury verdict that he did know, and that especially because he had such, the testimony kind of varied about when he did become aware of it. He didn't remember. He's not saying a specific date for sure that he knew of this. Don't we have to go back to the earliest date, which would have been the date that her name was on the list since he's personally involved in the case? Because of the inference of the jury?
I understand what the court's saying, but it's a complete failure of proof. Why is there anything? Why did
complete failure to what?
Complete failure of proof. There's no proof.
But isn't that some evidence? I'm asking, is that some inference from the circumstantial evidence in the case?
We believe it's insufficient.
Okay.
And in light of these, in the Mato case and the Cheney case, I would also say that if the economics, teaching economics requirement is upheld, then their actual damages have to be redone because they're entirely dependent on teaching economics. Now, with respect to, I discussed the primary witness issue. As to when she found out, it's irrelevant when she found out, but she said she was written a letter on January 26th, and she testified she was told on February 17th. Why they keep saying April, I don't know. It really doesn't matter. That's page 956 to 960.
Why is it irrelevant when she found out? Isn't it relevant because that you're talking about the 18 hours, right?
Yeah. The college has the right to assign anybody who wants to, any course who wants to teach. That's in the contract. You have to teach what they tell
you. Right,
but
if she wanted to have the chance to compete for that position and she's not given the same information everybody else is, that could raise an inference of retaliation.
There is no disparate treatment proof in this record. There was a convocation where it was announced. He says she didn't show up. That was in January. There was a vice president named Moss, I believe, excuse me, I may have the wrong name. Anyway, there's a vice president who had to quit teaching economics because he didn't have the 18 hours. There's no proof that she wasn't treated exactly like everybody else with respect to these academic requirements.
Okay. Counsel, I think you need to wrap it up.
Okay. As to the maximum recovery rule, counsel has it backwards. Remittiture was requested. Was requested under the debated decision of this court. We think the proper remittiture would be to $10,000 like Beatty. Remittiture is constitutional, Judge Reed. The maximum recovery rule helps them. It steps in and says this court will remit to 50% higher than the comparable. We only introduced the maximum recovery rule because we felt it was our obligation as lawyers. We would be happy to throw it out and have a remittiture to $10,000.
Thank you. This case is